Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's October 20th, 2019, and welcome to episode 201 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz? Will I ever find...
RTR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, computer store memories, and other, you know, stuff. I don't know. I never think ahead as to what I'm going to say in that point. And so, as is clear, I am Paul Hegstrom in Boston, and I am joined by two retro computing enthusiasts, one of whom is Carrington Manston in Toronto. How are you?
I'm excellent.
And
thanks for having me.
Yes. And the other of whom is Jack Nutting in Stockholm. How are you?
Hello. I'm doing pretty good.
Excellent. All right. The host topic for today is computer store memories. Kind of like a thing we all remember, I'm sure, that we used to go hang out in computer stores or see computer stores, I think, right? And that's something that doesn't really exist much anymore, but at least for some of us was kind of an important point in our computing life. So maybe we can just kind of like go around and reminisce a little bit about what we remember about computer stores, if there are any computer stores in our current life, that kind of thing. So, I don't know, Carrington, you earlier over email said you approved of the topic, so does that mean you've thought about it?
No. Yeah, actually it does. I think it's a great topic, and I have lots of fond memories of computer stores. They aren't really a part of my life anymore, with the exception of things like the Apple Store, but honestly, that doesn't feel like a computer store. When I think of the phrase computer store, what I'm thinking of is a thing from my past that had a very different feel and look and vibe than the modern Apple Store. Although I guess in a sense the Apple Store is just the new version, but it's just really not the same. As late as the 90s and stuff, I used to frequent Macintosh computer stores. There were a few downtown I quite liked, but I don't have a lot of nostalgia for them. My nostalgia is for much earlier ones back, like most nostalgia, it comes back from the high school times. Mm-hmm. And the first high school I went to, that I got kicked out of because that's a thing that happens to me apparently, was Earl Haig. I was in a quote-unquote gifted program there, and it was near Yonge Street, and the positioning of the high school was such that during lunchtime, you could leave the school and walk over to Yonge Street, and I could do things like go to the computer store that was quite nearby or go to an arcade. This is the kind of activity that might get one kicked out of school, although that was not the reason I was kicked out. But there was an arcade there that I quite liked, but more than that, there was a computer store that I adored. And so I would just go hang out there. I would just go, you know, on my lunchtime, that's what I would do. Just go to the store and browse the stock that had not changed since the day before. But I just liked being around the things and looking at them and thinking about them and pestering the staff for details about stuff. And so I have strong, strong memories of that building, the outside of it. It was a 2 or 3 story building and the outside was all mirrored glass. So it had a real 80s monolithic look to it. And I don't even remember the name of the store. I don't think it was anything like a big brand. It wasn't a Computer Land or anything like that. It was just a computer store. And I adored it. And I would hang out there. And from that location, I bought lots of Apple II stuff. I bought Tandy things because they also carried Radio Shack stuff, which also seemed odd to me because you think they'd only get those at a Radio Shack. I also have fond memories of Radio Shacks. But I bought some things for my Coco that were like in a used bin at this place. So they seemed to get remainder things. I don't know. I just adored the place. My last memory of it was ages later, years after high school, driving down Yonge Street, going south, and seeing in the distance the sparkling gleam of a 3-story mirror glass it must be terrible to be a neighbor of that place. There's just blinding people and frying ants everywhere. But I could see the building. It glittered like a citadel in the distance. I was so excited. So I told the person I was driving with, that's one of my favorite places. It's this amazing computer store. It's going to be great. We're going to stop. I just need to duck in and like see what's there now because it's been years since I've been there. So we pull over and we find parking. I walk up to it and it is an ice hockey building of some sort. They don't have hockey there now, but they were selling sports equipment, but not all sports equipment, just skates and a few things to do with hockey, but not all hockey equipment. It was like the weird, like, what is that? What is this business even here? So it was kind of a skate place that carried kind of skates and then some other things like hockey equipment, but no gloves or some weird rule like that. So it had just become a disaster and disappointing. So that's how that story ends. That building still exists. Every once in a while I'll drive by it, and it has subsequently been a whole bunch of different businesses, but it's not the same as the gleaming mirrored citadel of new Apple II stuff and IBM things and weird remaindered Radio Shack stuff that I completely adored. So that's my all-time favorite computer store.
Cool.
Sweet.
Jack, did you have any computer store in your history?
Yeah, I have a few. Like, I remember, so I grew up as a teenager, I was in Austin, Minnesota, which was not, I mean, it's a small town. I think there was a computer store, but it was pretty small and it was kind of all the way across town. So like before I had a car, it was kind of inaccessible to me. I do remember going to things like, I remember that we would go, my stepbrother and I would go to this, there was a store for a while that was called Comb for some reason. It stood for something. It was an acronym. And it was just kind of like a reseller of like excess garbage remainders from other stuff. And they had a bunch of software that was on 5 1/4-inch floppies. This is probably like 1984, 85. And they just had just like bales full of the same. And I don't know if it was Atari or Commodore or Apple software or what it was, but we realized that just like the software on these floppies was cheaper than buying blank floppies. So we just bought this packaged software just to get at the floppies, to use the floppies, because they were so cheap compared to buying blanks. But I do have also distinct memories of places that, like in Houston, I'd get my dad to drive to someplace. It was also, you know, even worse, all the way across Houston. So it was like an hour drive kind of thing. But I remember, like, I found this place. I was like, wow, this seems like an amazing store that's got all this Atari stuff. And we drove over there, and it was amazing. And it was like, there was a ton of stuff, and there were people in the store trying things out and buying things. And I didn't have, like, I think I was almost overwhelmed and didn't have a budget, didn't really have money to spend on anything, so I didn't buy much. But, I have a few of those, and I kind of remember that over time, most of the sort of like mom and pop computer stores sort of got smaller and smaller and dwindled away. And like, I remember that by the time I was in college in Northfield, Minnesota, there was like a company that sold Amigas, but they primarily, like, it was a company that did video work. So they were doing like video production. They probably rented equipment. They probably did shoots and stuff. And they were selling Amigas, because on the Amiga you had the video toaster. You could actually interface with video signals and do some stuff. And so, like, I remember they had some games and they had some stuff. And I would go there and like talk to the guys, but it was already one of those things where it was kind of like clearly a lost cause, right? It was like they were selling, you know, they would sell stuff when they could, but there were not a lot of people buying Amigas in 1992 or whatever. So I don't know. I guess I loved finding cool computer stores. Didn't really have any sort of one that was like my home base store that I hung out at. I do remember seeing the very first time I saw a Mac was in a computer store, and this was I was in Rochester for some reason, Minnesota, and this was probably 1984, probably right after the Mac was released that same year. And there was a store in a shopping mall, and they had a Mac. And I remember like playing, they had like the paint program that you could like draw an ellipse, and it was incredible. You could use the mouse to create an ellipse. What a world.
Yeah. No color. Very slow.
No color, but patterns.
That's true.
You could draw an ellipse with a, filled with a pattern. Come on.
It was very sharp. I mean, I guess that was the thing. It was very,
it was
very crisp looking.
That's exactly my memory as well. It's about like how unbelievably sharp everything. I'm sure, you know, nowadays you go back and I don't care how sharp that CRT is supposed to be. I'd look at it now and go, whoa, that's fuzzy. But for the time, that was one of the most distinct memories of how crystal clear everything seemed. Every square little jagged dot, I can see it so clearly on that.
Right. And if you open a menu, you have plenty of time to admire, you know, all of those little squares as they as the menu rolls slowly.
The draw.
Yeah, I really didn't like that first round. But
how about you, Paul? What is your computer store memory?
Yeah, well, my experience is actually fairly similar to yours, Jack, in that there wasn't one that was close. Then there wasn't even really a one that was in town. You know, so to go, you'd have to go to the mall that was 25 minutes away, or, you know, to get to the kind of like dumb little ones. And I guess I didn't, most of my, you know, computer store type experiences were from like reading magazines or taking explicit trips out to a computer store, you know, when my parents would drive me or something. Right. Mm-hmm. So I would look at magazines and stores that would carry them. I would in Kmart, I would like type on the VIC-20 or whatever while looking severely down at it.
But, right. Yeah, like I remember using computers in stores that were not necessarily computer stores, like Kmart or Radio Shack. You know, you go to the Coco and you type a simple basic program, like probably something saying, you know, trash 80 sucks, just kind of rolling up the screen in an infinite loop or whatever.
Right.
But like, it was not really a computer store. And like, especially like where I lived, the guys who worked at Radio Shack, they did not care about the computers or know anything about the computers. They were just dudes working in a mall, you know?
Right. Yeah. There was an Apple authorized seller or whatever, that was in a mall that wasn't too far away from where I lived. And that was, I guess, to the extent that I went and bought stuff, that was the place I bought it. But also, it was super expensive. There was never, you know, it was a major thing to kind of like save up for a couple months to get some device, you know.
Right.
Or, you know, I'd work out some sort of thing with my parents where, you know, I would borrow a couple hundred dollars from them to get the thing now. But then it was you know, but then I'd have to pay them.
And right.
So it was, you know, the months while I'm waiting to pay them back, no new things were bought. It definitely was interesting, though, the selectivity you needed. I mean, you can't afford all the things. If there's, you know, you have enough money to buy maybe two software titles if you're lucky.
Right.
So you go to the wall and you figure out, like, which are the most important ones.
Right.
And you just pirate the heck out of the rest.
I do kind of remember after this, like, video game crash, 1984 or whatever, that, like, I remember there was a particular summer that I was in Houston visiting my dad, and like I noticed that we'd go to the shopping mall and places like toy stores, they would have software, right? They wouldn't have much computers. They would have games and stuff. And like I remember noticing, wow, this bargain bin has a bunch of stuff. Like I remember picking up games that were costing $3 or $4 instead of the $20 to $40 they usually were, you know, a game and a cartridge. I didn't reflect on it at the time. I didn't really understand what was going on, but it's like, that's cool. I remember buying some games that were dirt cheap. Some of them were also dirt terrible, but like, but still, you know, when you're so starved for software, because like you say, you can only afford a certain amount. You know, you're 13, and it's like, I don't have money to buy stuff or places to buy things if I would have money. So it's like, when you do find something, it's like, oh wow, I can afford to buy three games in one pop. Damn.
And then your parents say, language. Oh, and you know, I actually didn't say the source of this, which was that the topic was suggested by Rex over email. And so what Rex said was that back when I was a kid, the library and the computer store were my favorite hangouts and the only sources for new computer information through computer magazines. He would bike about 3 miles to the store every weekend and countless times during the summer to look at computers, try out software that was on display, and thumb through magazines until the employees were annoyed with me. Yeah, and I mean, I think it would be, like, I can sympathize with those experiences, but I never had them. There wasn't a local hangout store, unfortunately.
Mm.
Though I hear these stories from people. Anyway, yeah, the building is still there, Rex says, and the space is now a gas station, Subway sandwich stop. So, kind of similar.
Preach on. I know that feeling. Yeah. Yeah, we're lucky here in Toronto. We had lots of computer stores when I was a kid and right through the 90s, like tons of them. The Macintosh authorized retailers or whatever they were called, like lots of those and lots of computer stores prior to that, all through the 80s. Like, really, we're spoiled for choice in this city.
I'm trying to think, you know, when I started living in cities, you know, so when it got to be sort of like the late 90s, I would actually go to the campus computer store and, you know, like look around at the new Macs and stuff at the time. And that was kind of fun. I don't feel like that's the same era. Like it's, I don't have, I think I was too old to be getting these nostalgic memories, but I did hang out at these places. And now, of course, they barely exist.
Yeah, same thing. I mean, I spent a lot of time at Macintosh stores prior to the Apple stores, like the official ones coming out. And I have tons of memories of those, but just not the same nostalgia. And I really liked going there, and I would look at the software wall, and I bought computers, and I bought a lot of peripherals and parts and cables and like all that kind of stuff. And I talked to the staff members there, but it doesn't have the same nostalgic feeling because I was older, and like nostalgia often targets a younger age.
Yeah. Right.
I think that's the only reason, though.
And I do remember being somewhat saddened by the turn in, you know, most of the universities actually that I've been involved with, they used to have computer stores and they all got converted into just sort of like demo floors where you know this is, if you're lucky, you can see the computer that you would order, but you're not leaving with it, you know. you're gonna mail order it anyway.
Yeah, that's my recollection of because I spent so much time in universities, same thing, that move from actual computer stores to just like, here's where you could go online and order your stuff.
Yeah. It's somehow not as fun. I mean, it's a little more convenient maybe to have someone deliver it rather than have to lug it home, but.
Mm-hmm. Did either of you ever work in a computer store?
No, I did not. Never did.
Or like at university or anything like that? I never have.
Nope.
Nope. We probably all have been like, you know, behind tech support desks, but.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That was fun. I forget if I mentioned this before, but I was, for a little while, I was the lab assistant in the statistics lab. And I didn't know anything about, you know, this is as in the undergraduate, you know, college. And I didn't know anything about statistics, you know, I could, and this is a bunch of PCs. I barely knew anything about the computers either, but it had a big like projection screen in the front that I would play Tetris on after hours. That's the main thing I remember about this. You know, I was no help to any of the people that were in there, really. But it was a job.
But hey, it's a living.
Yeah.
Was that in the layered annex?
It was indeed, yeah.
I remember that projection system because it was the size of a small car. It was this enormous blob hanging from the ceiling.
Yep. But it was amazing because this was, I don't know what, you know, like, middle 90s, right? You know, so yeah, there was actually another room, auditorium in that same school that had a like much larger projection screen that I got to project. I did a project that involved programming a Mac 2 CX. It was basically simulating, you know, physics stuff, chaos stuff, chaotic dynamics things, but it was pretty wild to like project my little rotating wireframes onto this huge screen.
Cool.
Anyway, nothing to do with computer stores, though. Okay, well, maybe that's it for the computer stores, but, you know, I think we missed them in a sense.
Yeah.
Now I do occasionally go, but even now I really only go if I just don't want to wait 24 hours for the thing to be delivered.
Right.
So.
Well, I think one thing that's changed is that it used to be that there were some stores that computer stores that were kind of like a hobbyist store. Like, they were selling real stuff, but it was kind of like, you know, like today, there exist guitar stores that are just somebody's store. Then there's, like, you know, Guitar Center, the huge chain that's, you know, the big box store. But there are still guitar stores that are just like, you go in and it's somebody who owns it, and they buy things and they sell things. Computer stores were that way before, you know. Now, I could go to Fry's, I could go to Best Buy, and there are computers there, and I can see the computers. But it's not like, they're not computer stores. You're not going to, like, bump into a bunch of people there who are like, oh, Are you a computer user? I'm also a computer user.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah.
So I bet you a large percentage of people who buy computers buy them through places like Best Buy. But, you know, until you said that, it never even occurred to me to think of that as a computer store.
Right.
Right.
But, like, that's, you know, if you're not going to buy it online, that's probably where you're going to do it. You know, like Paul said, if you don't want to wait 24 hours for delivery, you need to have a cable or a mouse or whatever it is. You're probably going to go to Best Buy or Fry's or whatever and, like, oh, yeah, I know that they probably have, you know, 20 different mice and 20 different keyboards, and I can just get what I need.
Yeah.
In my experience, most of the people, like, I know the way my family shops for computers is they say, hey, Carrington. I'm like, oh, God.
And then you
and
hang
I
up.
Get the computer. And
you're breaking up.
I bring their data over, and I set the stupid thing up. And so, you know, welcome to being the tech person in the family, which I suspect a lot of our listeners know the pain of that.
Yeah.
How many times in my life I've thought, if I had just never told anybody I was interested in computers, I would have saved myself so much headache from not dealing with other people's problems. Your printer doesn't work. Oh, what a shame. Nothing I can do about it.
Yeah. I guess it's also the case, too, that there isn't at this point a computer culture, really. I mean, there are gamers and things, I suppose, or but generally speaking, everybody is a computer user and nobody is sophisticated.
Right. Yeah, like there are computer users just like there are television users and refrigerator right. users. Like everybody's got one. Everybody uses it for some stuff, but it's not like for, you know, for the vast majority of them, it's not a thing that they care about, you know, as long as it works. Mm-hmm. But like if it breaks, they'll get another one and they will forget the old one.
Yeah, that's definitely a difference between me and most of the people in my life, because as a kid, the idea that I could own a computer, like a full-on real computer that was mine, that I would program, that wasn't like through a gatekeeper, it wasn't a timeshare thing, it wasn't some big fancy thing in the university, it was like my computer that was mine, was magical and enticing and just one of the most important things in the world. And I know my nephew, who's, you know, less than half my age, is like, whatever, 15 computers in my pocket, everything runs in the cloud. Who would want a computer? Phones are awesome. Computers are stupid. So I'm just me and probably a lot of our listeners were in that little bump in history of the idea of a personal computer being something you'd even want or care about. And it's such this massive, important philosophical thing to me. And everyone else is like, clouds are great. I'm like, clouds are gatekeepers. Power to the people. Like, I have such strong feelings about this. And like, the fact that software doesn't run on my computer, it's mostly on someone else's, that offends me. But I'm out of step with the world. Like, I just, you know, die off with my keyboard and stuff, and everyone else will just have their little combination microphone and speakers that sit in the corner listening 24/7 and they just talk to them and it plays the music and whatever. That's, I think everyone wants that. Everybody, as a kid, I never would have anticipated that everybody really would prefer to go back to the white coats and the gatekeepers. I don't want to deal with that. Just give me my game. But man, I still, the whole notion of a personal computer, that phrase is so powerful to me and so delightful and important. I get that I'm out of step, but I love computers.
Yeah.
Like actual real computers.
Right. Yeah, it's not clear that you love the, whatever it is, the Amazon Dot or whatever, but you know.
Not so much.
1980s computers.
Yeah.
I do kind of wonder if there was a, whenever this would have been, you know, end of the previous century, if there was a similar kind of thing with refrigerator enthusiasts.
Like actual ice, that's mine, man.
Suddenly everybody has a refrigerator and nobody cares anymore.
Right.
Could be.
Okay. Perhaps that's enough of the computer store topic. But
poor old man Carrington starts ranting again.
But thank you, Rex, for suggesting that. That was interesting. Mm-hmm.
That's a great topic.
Other listener feedback that we got. I feel like I didn't do a very thorough job of sifting through this, so there's only a couple. But Brent wrote over email talking about what old technology did it better. You know, we talked about that, I think, 2 episodes ago. Brent's idea was that it was VCRs. You could record anything you wanted on inexpensive media, and because the media was inexpensive and, you know, the image quality was reasonable for the broadcasts of the time, that gives you sort of essentially unlimited storage, so you can keep it and archive it and give it away and play it on other machines, even at other people's houses. Companies going under or losing distribution rights don't affect your ownership of that tape with its content. And that's true. That's rather different from the way things often are now.
All great points. I can't believe it had never occurred to me at the time, but those are great points. And yep. And if you would fail to record something, say at a VCR, you're trying to record the latest, Rockford Files, because sure you should. Right. And so you set it to record Friday nights at 8 or whatever that would play. If it didn't record, you come back like, oh, I missed it because I set it for AM instead of PM, or I forgot to hit record or whatever. It's kind of fair. It's like, I messed up, so it didn't record. Nowadays, it's like, did my digital video recording get it? No. Why? Ha! You'll never know. Just pray that I record it next time if I'm in the mood. And so, like, the ownership of your own media and the fact that you can kind of understand it better. And yeah, the quality is not great now, but you got to look at it in context. And so I agree. VCRs, chunky, couldn't record 15 things at once, but who wants to watch that much television anyway? I dig it. Yep. Great answer. Yeah. I think that's an excellent choice.
Have I ever talked about my VCR setup? I don't know if I have, but like
current
no,
VCR setup.
But but back, I guess this is back in sort of like the late 90s. You might not believe this, but I have something of like a collector bug.
No,
you.
And so I kind of had to like record all the episodes of various things, and I got kind of deep into television. So I didn't have time to watch ads, so I would tape things, but I wouldn't tape over things because.
Oh, I bet you regret that now.
Oh, well, no, I mean, I didn't. What I'm saying is, like, I would tape the things and then fast forward through the ads rather than.
Oh, I see. Right. Because for me, I would like to go back and watch shows as they broadcast. Like, I wish ads, I would want to watch old TV shows with a contemporary ad in. Yeah. I'd be more interested in the serial ad than the show, I think.
Yeah, I know. I am hoping that I will at some point capture these. So I have boxes and boxes and boxes of videotapes, of course, at this point. But the way I had it set up, I had, I think, 3 different VCRs because they would each have, I think, 6 or 8 programming slots in them. And I had this, like, Perl program that I wrote that would, it kept track of a template of recurring shows, and I could add things in there, and it kept track of which episodes I was missing so that it would alert me. It would scrape the TV listings and check to see what I needed, and then.
You're a madman and beautiful.
Was,
I love it.
It was great though, but so I had it. It was aware of the 6 slot maximum, and of course, like, no. So if there was simultaneous shows, I had to have 2 different VCRs in 2 different rooms. Like trigger.
Right. So how many times did you have to sort of leave some event, something you were doing, to go home and switch tapes?
Oh well, that was actually I did not. I think I didn't generally have to do that, but I did have to be pretty careful about that. Particularly
right.
If I was leaving for vacation or something, that right. That was quite rough. But this program also kept track of like what was on each tape, so that I knew how much was left.
Okay.
So
amazing.
It was quite an elaborate system actually, and now my storage unit has several, many many boxes full of videotapes that have. I think I forget that, I had some sort of alphabetical label that went up to like 3 digits or 3 letters. I mean, like they have a lot of tapes.
That's what I'm saying. I got a lot of tapes. So just so I'm clear though. So when you would fast forward through commercials, watching things, but you actually recorded them though.
Right. Right.
So your tapes would be full of, so when you get around to digitizing them, leave the commercials in, man. Yeah. Some of us want to see them.
Yeah. And I need to hurry up and do that because of course magnetic media is degrading. And since then, I've actually,
So you say that, that's just, you're in the pocket of big CD.
Right. Right. My collection bug hasn't gone away, but a lot of these things I have
we know.
Kind of newer versions of. So I did toss a bunch of tapes because the things that were on them I had in better quality some other way.
Mm. But not the commercials, man.
Yeah, I know. See, I'm thinking about that now. But
think of all the Booberry commercials that they're lost to history now, like Tears in Rain.
Yeah. However, I mean, it is interesting. Some of the stuff I've taped pretty indiscriminately. And some of those things you can't find now. I mean, sitcoms and things that lasted a season.
Mm.
Yeah. So I think it's interesting. Somebody must have them, but they're not on any streaming sites or.
Not necessarily. It could be you got stuff that no one else has.
Could be. Yeah. Could have all burned down in a fire or whatever.
The hard part is with something like a VCR tape, it's hard to get it off that in anything other than real time.
Oh, right? Yeah, you're right.
So if you want to digitize 3,000 hours worth of video, it's going to take you 3,000 hours.
See,
it's a daunting task.
That didn't help.
You need like a machine that you can load things in. It'll just do it behind the scenes or something. Because then you could scrub it and just put something in, just something that just takes tapes as an auto feed or something. Jason Scott can hook you up with something.
There's gotta be. There has to be a machine that does this.
And you should, you could start collecting those.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, one other piece of listener feedback that I feel sad about. Jim wrote over Twitter to say, "So, no mention of VCF Midwest. It was September 14th to 15th, with 1,200 plus attendees, the largest vintage computing festival in the USA."
Maybe we felt it didn't need advertising.
Yeah,
too many people were already going.
I have no idea how that slipped.
How did we miss that?
Yeah, I was sort of. I mean, I feel like I was sort of aware of it happening, but somehow. Anyway, there was no intentional snub. I don't understand. But anyway, we'll try to advertise these in the future.
See, that's why people in the Midwest are rightfully skeptical of those of us on either side of the continent. It's like, ugh.
Yeah. Anyway, that's embarrassing. But I'm glad it went well. And I assume there will be another one next year. Everyone should go.
Right.
But, okay. Now we can sort of turn to the items of interest and news. Carrington, you have the first one of these.
Well, I thought I'd start us off with the fluffiest fluff that ever fluffed. So in case anybody feels like cuddling a bunny, I have something even fluffier for you, which is a thing on Business Insider, video games then and now. So what 11 popular video games looked like when they first came out and then today. So it's all stuff like what did Donkey Kong look like then? What's the latest version of Donkey Kong? And Oregon Trail, of course. Talks about John Madden Football from 1988, and it was groundbreaking, and look at the crappy graphics. And then it shows, meanwhile, Madden NFL 20. From 2019, weirdly, looks like you're watching a real life NFL game. But if you look at the photo, I'm like, no, it doesn't. I mean, the new ones look like much better graphics, but I wouldn't be fooled. I wouldn't look at that and think it's real. We still got a ways to go. But it is kind of neat to see these, you know, what was then, what was now, discussions, and each one has a single screenshot. So you can look at King's Quest from 1983, and then look at King's Quest Epilogue from 2015, which I didn't even know was a thing. Mm-hmm. And that looks pretty cool. So I'm glad to know about a new King's Quest game, or like, 4-year-old but new to me King's Quest game. So that was the main reason I bookmarked it, because I'm like, hey, new King's Quest, cool. And you know, it's got all the stuff you would think of, Doom and Sims and that sort of stuff. So you can see a screenshot from old stuff that they mock, but I kind of prefer, and a screenshot from new stuff that they say looks amazing. And I'm like, eh, not my thing. So this whole article convinced me that I am out of step with the fluffy bunnies that wrote it. But it's neat to look at pictures of old video games, and that's why I'm adding it to our list.
Nice.
I mean, at least in a lot of these cases, they really do kind of feel like the one that looks old looks more fun, you know?
Exactly. It probably runs on your own computer, man.
Right. That's true. You can own the media. I mean, so Doom was cool, and it had, you know, it was sort of trying to look real, but it never did look real.
No.
It wasn't fully immersive. And
yeah, and also in this, one of the last ones they pick, it shows Galaxian arcade game, obviously, amazing one from 1979. It says it's one of the earliest games to use color. I'm like, well, okay, yeah, kind of, but and then compares it to Galaga Revenge 2019, and I wanted to put my hand up back in class. I'm like, Galaga was its own game, first of all. And the Galaga Revenge one is clearly like a phone game, looks ridiculous.
Right.
Just like full of stuff on the screen. I'm like, that's just for people who are just like in the throes of puberty and just need to bash on something. Like, come on, this doesn't look like a fun game. Whereas Galaxian and the original Galaga, classics. So a person wrote this, fluffy bunny named Dave Johnson, wrong about everything. Old game's good, new game's bad.
Right. Agreed.
There you go. Old man yells at cloud.
No, I totally agree. And also, like, in the very last one they talk about, Breakout. Like, they show Breakout, which is, you know, it's Breakout. It's clear and clean and simple. And they show some cyberpunk VR as the modern thing, which just looks like a mess. Like, I don't want to play that game ever.
That looks terrible.
Oh, my gosh. You know, I don't even think I got that far in. I think I bailed on this before I got to the end of the article. Yeah, Pong, classic. Totally understand it. Or Breakout, rather.
Yeah.
Amazing. Cyberpunk VR.
Nope.
Wowzers.
Yeah. Nope.
That is full-on cyber looking, like, right from the 90s.
Yes.
2016? Really?
Yep.
Okay, cool. Straight up, it says it's straight out of a sci-fi movie. Yeah. Yeah, Lawnmower Man.
Right, or Tron or something. Yeah.
Hey, don't say bad things about Tron.
Oh, well, not the Lawnmower Man.
Yeah. I have no bad things to say about Tron. I was just in New York not long ago. Whatever. There's a Dave & Buster's there, which is a like arcade/eating place.
Use arcade in quotes when you talk about Dave & Buster's.
Well, yeah, so I mean, like, I wandered around there. I was trying to kill time while I waited for like the time to leave, and I didn't end up playing anything because it really this, what reminded me basically was just like looking at this and thinking about what a lot of this stuff was just a phone game big. Like, they just have a lot of.
It's all redemption games. It's all play, get tickets, trade in for stuff. It's like, oh, yeah. I want to get nothing for my games, man. Don't try to give me a thing.
But there really were a lot of Angry Birds and stuff. Anyway, old games are better, in summary.
Shocking conclusion for Retro Gaming Roundtable. Yeah.
Okay, Jack, what's your thing here?
Is it me? Is it me?
It is the thing that I tried to steal, but.
Yes. Stealing my stories. So there was a news thing that popped up a few years ago, actually, about that the Strategic Air Command, or something called the Strategic Automated Command and Control System, was using 8-inch floppies to contain the nuclear launch codes. So, like, if they were going to launch missiles, they'd have to pop out an old 8-inch floppy and stick it into something to make it happen. And people were kind of surprised about this when this revelation came out. Apparently 60 Minutes covered this way back in 2014. And this summer they have gotten rid of it. They haven't really explained what they've replaced it with exactly. I think they kind of don't want to say. But I've posted an interesting article from a website that I do not know. C4ISRnet. I don't know what this is, but I found it. But the article is interesting. It does talk about the people who are doing some of the work in terms of maintaining these systems and maintaining the software and improving things. And they do point out the fact in here also that the older systems are in some ways inherently more secure because none of them are online. They're not on the internet. They're not on any kind of network. They're just like, you know, anything that's only input is a keyboard and floppies. Like, you can't hack it from anywhere else. So.
Hmm. Heard of security through obscurity? So yes. This is like security through inferiority. It can't do anything. You couldn't make it do anything.
Security through obsolescence.
You're immune to your attempts.
So anyway, pretty interesting. I saw this pop up in a few different places, and I searched around and found an article that seems to cover it fairly well. It also has some nice pictures of old computers, old rack-mounted things that are unidentifiable but look cool.
So what do you think they switched to? Paper tape?
Yeah. Actually, I mean, the thing is, that's probably pretty durable, maybe more so than the floppies, but...
I think they probably just switched to a Twitter account.
Yeah, right. It's just like, it's connected to some IRC channel.
There's this thing that floats around the net that seems ridiculous to me, so I do not believe it, even though part of me wants to, is that the main US launch code or whatever for ages was just 6 zeros. There was never actually a number to it. It was a 6-digit number, but it was all zeros. I'm like,
could be
neat, you know, kill us all and all, but
I mean, you know, the chance of guessing that randomly is the same as any other 6-digit number.
But if you're going to brute force it, it's either going to get it immediately or not till the very end.
Right. Okay. It couldn't be 0000000 or whatever, so we'll start with 1.
And they're like, ha ha, we fooled them.
Yeah. Cool.
And actually reading this, it occurred to me that I don't think that I've ever held in my hands an 8-inch floppy disk. I have a quarter plenty. I've seen some 8-inch, but I don't think I've never had a system that actually used them in any way. So I've never sort of dealt with them.
I have held them, but never had a computer that used one.
Yeah, I think that's... And I have held them, but I've never used a computer that I had that used them. But yeah, I have somewhere on, you know, like deep in my Twitter account, I have a photo of me holding this up and saying something about, like, you know, how if you ever want to feel small again,
you ever get small,
they're comically large.
Right.
Okay, let's see. So my news item is it's posted on the Computer History Museum's site, and it's called The Earliest Unix Code, an Anniversary Source Code Release. So Dennis Ritchie, co-writer of, I think, C, right, or Unix at least, had a black binder in amongst his things called the Unix Book 2, and that was entrusted to the Computer History Museum to preserve, and they have scanned it and made it available online. This is 2019 marks the 50th anniversary of the start of Unix. So in the summer of 1969 is when this all sort of kicked off. This was most centrally Ken Thompson and Dennis Ritchie constructing a new operating system using a then aging DEC PDP-7 computer at the labs.
Oh, it's now aging too.
Yep. That's true.
Well, it's just aging then.
So that's pretty cool. Because, of course, Unix is still deep at the heart of everything these days.
Right.
Unix is a fad. What's ever going to come of that? I mean, really, name one thing that's run on Unix.
But so it's cool. They have a, I think it's a 190-page PDF scan of the binders, and it's got source code listings from a bunch of things. It's not like on GitHub.
Including space travel from 1970. I was reading about that. That's super cool.
So there's a little bit of sort of notes in this article that we're linking to that sort of walks through like what you can see on some of the different pages. I mean, like you just download the 190-page PDF and skim through it, but there's assembly listing for LN for creating links to files and LS for listing file names.
Cool.
Moo. I didn't know what Moo was. Apparently it's a number guessing game. So not everything was serious. I guess they had to keep people entertained as well. But
I like the idea of like you forget like how basic some things have to have, that you gotta have a way to list the file names. It's like, what's on there? I just had a great idea for a feature.
Yeah. Right. So anyway, yeah, I mean, I think it's neat to be able to look through it. It's cool that it was both saved and scanned. So,
yes.
Thank you, Computer History Museum. Nice. Happy anniversary, Unix. Take a look at that if you have a chance. And with that, Carrington.
I bring you to Russia, my friend.
Perfect, yes. So, more accents, please.
Apparently, the Lenin Museum, or as they were originally called, ideological-emotional centers,
mm-hmm.
of course they were, the Lenin Museums, were and still are run at their heart by an Apple II computer, which is amazing. It's the most Russian thing ever. Like, of course they are. Oh, yeah.
That's cool.
So the Lenin Museums needed, like, I guess, according to the story, and a few people picked it up, as far as I can tell, like the original write-up about that's what we'll link to, which was an Atlas Obscura. Now, of course, that couldn't be original because they just gathered stuff from other places, but I can't find the main source they were using, so we'll link to that one. It got picked up by iMore, which is the one that got the most traction, but they were really just quoting stuff from the Retro Obscura one. So Russia decided we want to have a Lenin Museum. But at the time, everybody kind of, I guess, already knew everything about Lenin. It was such one of those people that just was completely documented. So you have to make it exciting. It can't just be a bunch of pictures and words. So they said, we got to have some projections. We got to have moving stuff, projected video, who knows what. So we need a computer system at the heart of this. Now, of course, being Russia, they have to show that Russian things are the best, and so they can't use a non-Russian thing. But the one they want to use is based out from a British company, and it's using an Apple II at its heart. So what does one do? Especially because you're not allowed to bring certain tech into Russia, and Russia wanted to say that it's a full Russian thing. So there's this whole kind of story behind the story as well. So the centers, the ideological, emotional, whatever centers still exist, and they still are powered by an Apple II with a huge remote. There's a picture and some of these that show these massive chunky rote with unlabeled buttons to launch things. And that remote has a brand on it, which is the brand of the British company that they got to supply this. But the British company couldn't supply it directly because otherwise there'd be like a record of Russia needed some other country's stuff. So instead another Russian company kind of brokers a deal, gets this stuff, and then they, you know, develop it with basically saying, well, we're not saying where it came from, and then they provide it to Russia so that Russia can say, oh, look, this amazing thing with full Russian technology. Don't look what's inside the box. And so it's kind of neat as a vestige of the Cold War and Russia's need to have only Russian stuff, I guess, and the fact that it's still running an Apple II today, which is ridiculous, but if it still operates and all you need to do is press a button to make a projector go, then what the heck? And it's an example of a simpler computer being something that it can just run and run and run and run because it never wants an update because there are no updates.
Right. And it doesn't know the world exists outside.
Well, that's it. You put a 10-year-old older computer in, and it no doubt would have already had a problem because there would have been updates for security or whatever. Apple II can just sit there just plugging away as if it's an embedded machine, essentially, just a really big one. So it's kind of neat. So we'll have a link to the article about it. Mother Russia still using the Apple II.
Cool.
Oh, Russia, you're so wrong in so many ways.
It's interesting. There was a clone. There must have been Russian clones, but there was a Bulgarian clone called a Pravets. That it was essentially just a complete. And Pravets would not say this, but it was just a complete ripoff of the Apple II. You know, I mean, an actual just clone. And I would think that they would have been able to source those.
Yeah, in fact, a British company. That's kind of. Was their claim to fame. They developed this whole system that would be inserted into an Apple II and be operated by an Apple II, but they could sell it without the Apple II. So somebody could just buy this whole thing that let them export it to countries that you couldn't necessarily export computer equipment. And then that person at the other end was just on their own to go acquire an Apple II. And so that was why a lot of countries maybe outside of the Western world used this system, I guess.
And in the article...
Indeed, I hadn't heard about any
of this. The article does say that there was a Soviet Apple II clone called the Agate 7.
Oh yeah,
but it wouldn't work because it had different slots.
Ah,
it had 60-pin slots instead of 50-pin slots, so it wouldn't work with the hardware that was made for the Apple II by this British company.
Ah,
all right.
Tripped up by the slots.
I haven't seen it yet, but I have a Pravets, sort of. Like my in-laws have a Pravets for me.
Okay.
Just the one?
Just the one, yes. And I've seen one made an appearance at Kansas Fest a couple years ago.
At Kansas Fest, yeah. I remember that as well.
Not working initially, but... I think it's working now. I don't know. Anyway, so it'll be interesting to play with that. Mainly what I want to do is like turn on this Cyrillic mode. Once I've done that, my tasks with it are done. But anyway, okay, let's see. We can move on to the upcoming show roundup.
Will we talk about them all? Who knows? Stay tuned.
That's right. We might just omit one randomly.
Yeah, let's pick one to pick on.
So... We don't actually, the list is not too long. I think there are, and maybe that's because we're missing some, but it could also be that the dates aren't set for a number of them. So there are regular shows that we, you know, don't have the dates and times for. But coming up pretty soon is, and pretty recently announced, is WASFest 14.25045 megahertz. The WASFest, it's an Apple II, it's a small Apple II gathering in Sydney, and every instance they've... So I guess this is the 14th one. So it can't be the 14th year, can it? Maybe it's the 7th year?
It can't be the 14th one, can it?
I don't think there was a 13. I think it's gone. I think it's gone from like 6 to 14 or something like that. Anyway, they're always just trying to find something that's kind of like 6502 or Apple II related. And I think 14.2405 megahertz is the speed of some crystal on the Apple II board. Anyway, November 23rd in Sydney, there's a little Apple get-together. We'll have a link to that. VCF Pacific Northwest, March 21st to 22nd in Seattle at the Living Computer Museum and Labs. I think Earl said he was going to go to that. So you can, if you go, you can meet Earl. I volunteer Earl for a meeting. And then VCF East, April 24th to 26th in Wall, New Jersey at the InfoAge Science Center. And...
See, we're apparently willing to talk about VCFs. Yeah. Just, you know, we're picky about which ones we mention, apparently.
It's so weird. I don't know. VCF Midwest, I'm sure, is great. Everybody go to that one also. But I guess it's not going to be until next September, presumably. Anyway, I think that is enough of that. And now a word from our sponsor.
VCF Midwest.
When you want to play the hottest, fastest, most advanced fighting game ever, forget everything else and play Doom 2 on your PC. No other game gives you the incredible realism, the 360-degree smooth scrolling, and explosive action like Doom 2. It's easy to start playing, but it won't let you stop. Doom 2, it will consume you. Play solo against a computer, against a buddy by modem, or online in an awesome four-way deathmatch. Doom 2, playing in a PC software store near you.
The trouble with most notebooks this size is that most hands are this size. That's why we created the 4.5-pound ThinkPad 701 and gave it a price that makes it easy to get your hands on one.
And we're back. So the retro computing gift idea for this time, not a pillow, but a cufflink. So, or cufflinks, I guess they come in pairs. So these are from FrenchCuffed.com. They are $15. They come with free shipping. They're like a little PC, basically. It's like a black cufflink with a little sort of like, IBM PC type shape on it. You know, so it's got a monitor, a type of box. If you want to sneak a little bit of vintage computer tech into your classy evening, this is one way to do it.
Yeah. I noticed that, which I hadn't seen before, up under the name Vintage Computer Cufflinks, it's part of a collection, and their collection is Technology Cufflinks. Uh-huh. And so there's a bunch, mostly more modern things like logos, Amazon, Apple, but there's a Commodore logo cufflink.
Uh-huh.
So that'd be fun. And there's also a old floppy disk logo, so there's a few, and a VHS tape. So, Paul, you could rock that one.
That's cool.
So there's some other ones as well. So there's some neat ones here.
Unlike this one.
the one we picked is neat too, but a Commodore logo cufflink, that's, you know, not for me, but going to be for somebody.
Yeah, no, I like that one actually. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. So there's some other tech cufflinks on here, all of which seem to be going for $15. Mm-hmm. So pretty cheap way to get yourself some cufflinks. They'll also, according to the site, you can design your own. I think they're just using it as like a button press, so you can kind of send them anything, and they'll knock you out some cufflinks.
Cool.
So get some maybe original Apple logo ones in the 6 color. They've got the old Apple logo, just white on black. Oh, no, they've got the vintage cufflink. They've got the 6 color logo, too. So, neat.
Very cool.
I might be interested in some cufflinks.
I need to find some occasion to use a cufflink. But
yeah, I don't have any French cuff shirts. Yeah. Twice a year, well, 3 times a year technically, but only twice that are black tie. My girlfriend lives in Canada. He wouldn't know her. Ding. we go to the. She, by the way, is a little astounded that I keep making that joke. Why do you say that anyway? she's struggling with it a little bit. Hello, Rachel. We go to a thing called the Royal. How snobby is that? Which is like a horse jumping show. She's into horses. I'm into keeping my girlfriend. So we both go to this thing. And two of the nights for that are black tie. So I wear cufflinks to those. And maybe I could get away with rocking some original. I suspect that I can't.
Yeah.
Actually, I think I'll be told that those are inappropriate. And my girlfriend would prefer me to wear something else. And I'm there for her. So I won't be getting those.
Darn it.
There you go.
Well, you could get something like the Apple Mac power button cufflinks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because those are not like, they're not a corporate logo. They're just, it's just a design. Mm-hmm. If you know what it is, you know what it is. If you don't, you just think, oh, it's kind of a circle with a line in it.
And the best part was if I press it, if it makes like a Mac startup chime.
Yes. And glows.
And glows. Yeah. I'd be all about that. A friend of mine, so I have used, I think I've mentioned this on earlier episodes, I have used a snippet from Groundhog Day, like the radio program. It says, you know, it's cold out there, as my morning thing that wakes me up. Like when my alarm goes off, it plays that. And it has never stopped to be amazing. In the now few years I have used it. It entertains me every time I wake up, the fact that it's a Groundhog Day thing. It never stopped getting old. But I have a friend of mine who uses an old startup chime, which I kind of wish I had thought of. I might have ripped off instead. So her alarm goes off with a vintage computer startup chime, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, I like it.
Yep.
Okay, anyway. So when you're done buying all the many different interesting cufflinks, that you can get here, and then looking for places to wear them, you can go to eBay and buy things there. And looks like we have a number of things to tell you about. Carrington, you have the first of that number.
The first thing I'm doing is picking a computer I've never heard of before, but it's kind of neat. Or maybe we've talked about it. It kind of seems vaguely familiar. It's a Sharp MZ811. I didn't even look it up, and so it's not the version of the computer I think is the good one. It's like a Sharp computer. I don't know why one would want one of those, but it's $500 for a new old stock computer still in box. So if you're interested in the Sharp computers, maybe this is a good buy. I guess there was a version of this computer that had an inbuilt cassette player though, and this looks like it's the version that doesn't have that, which is not nearly as fun. So that's a shame. But it's a neat computer, so I wanted to give a shout out to people who are interested in old Sharp computers. There's one available new in box for $500 currently on, and that's this. There's also a make offer, but that's the buy it now. Either of you guys know anything about the Sharp?
No.
No.
Paul, do you have six of these?
No. I mean, I think you're right that we did talk about something in this series. This is that sci-fi man, same, you know, the seller from Nova Scotia.
Right. I never see you eBay pros think to look at that. I never ever look at who's selling a thing.
But I think this is the same seller who had some of the prior Sharp things too. So.
Oh, there you go. So if you want the other ones, you can get them from that. Next one I'm picking because we talked about trackballs a couple episodes ago, and I talked about the one I had that I completely loved that had a ball that you could replace, and it came with a few different colors, but I had replaced mine. There was like novelty ones you could buy. You could buy an 8-ball and stuff. And it was this silhouette trackball, and I don't remember it looking like this at all. In fact, when I saw this one for sale, I'm like, that's not how it looks, but it is. And so it just shows you, boy, my memory can be completely wrong. I remembered it being open to the one side, like when you could kind of grab around the ball, but I don't remember having a big EMAC logo on the side of it at all. But apparently it did. And I used to not care about massive logos on things, apparently. But this was my favorite trackball of all time. And there's a version, I don't think this is rare. This is probably not even a good price for it, but for $50 is a buy it now. And it's available in box with the four little color balls that come with it. It comes with a red, a yellow, a purple-ish sort of thing, and like a cyan color. So you pick which of those four you want, and you can swap them around. But more fun was there were a whole bunch of other balls available. I don't know if they came from EMAC or other parties made them or whatever, but that was the fun thing about this, is you could have a whole bunch of different balls and swap in different kind of track balls. And so it made it super fun to work with. So it's my favorite trackball that I've ever owned. And you could own it, have the vintage Carrington experience for $50.
So those cool trackballs are not actual, like, billiard ball sized, right? I mean, they're not...
No, they're smaller. Okay.
It would be pretty cool if you could just actually use an 8-ball.
Well, that'd be even better. But no, I'm pretty sure they were a smaller thing, that you couldn't use an actual 8-ball. But there was an 8-ball... Maybe I'm wrong about that. No, I think I would have used an 8-ball then.
Right.
Because I had one that was... in fact, it wasn't even an 8-ball. I think I had like a 9-ball or something ridiculous, and I wanted the 8-ball, but somebody gave me a different one. It's a vague memory. I also remember this looking different. Maybe it's discolored, right, or whatever.
Maybe it wasn't actually even you.
You know, that wasn't me. But no, ergonomically, it just, you could set your wrist on it and kind of grip it like your hand was in rictus, but weirdly super comfortable for long use. Like, I just can't even express how much I enjoyed using this thing. It's one of my favorite input devices of all time. And so because we talked about it, I was thinking about it, and when I was looking for stuff on eBay, I thought, I wonder, and there it is. Probably comes up all the time. Not worth buying this one. I just want to give it another shout out. And then for my third choice, kind of fun, I have the 1988 Kodak Display Maker. So the Display Maker from Kodak, like a lot of things from Kodak, was a complete failure. Anything they did outside of cameras, disastrous. Mm-hmm. So there used to be a thing called the Video Display, the something, that was like the big name in this stuff. I mean, a lot of, like we talked about earlier, people use Amigas to do things with a video toaster, but for a device, imagine just like you buy a device that is self-contained, and what it does is it takes a video input, gives you a video output, and you can overlay graphics and do stuff on it and monkey with it as a self-contained piece of hardware. It was in that category. But by the time it came out, there was one video something that was like it owned the category, and the claim to fame of the Display Maker was it did a lot less, was a lot worse, had way worse features, but it was cheaper. And so, but nobody wanted it, because the only reason you'd use this would be in like video production, and TV producers weren't looking to save $2,000. They were looking to use the industry standard good one. So this was just like a disaster. But what's neat about it, it would still technically work. I guess we get a standard def NTS video signal. You just run it through and do neat things. But it's got to buy it now of $4,000. I think back in the late 80s, it probably had a retail price of like $4,500. So it should have gone down more than that, to be perfectly honest. But if you're really looking for one, here is one. What's neat about this, though, in reading about it, when I was trying to remember if I was right that this was the one from Kodak, which was crappy, versus like Kodak wasn't the lead person. So I just Googled Kodak Display Maker, and the very first thing that Google gave me was, here is an auction where it was available for $10 from Goodwill. And it had no buyers. I was like, Well, isn't that interesting? No bids. It was $10, and you could have had it from Goodwill of Central and Southern Indiana. Like, what a shame. I guess some. And a lot of times when things don't sell on the Goodwill site, it's because somebody went in and bought it from the store. So back in September of 2018, you could have bought. Oh, actually, October of 2018, you could have bought this for $10, and now it's on eBay for $4,000. So you wonder what maybe happened that $10 one. Well, Lazy Gamer Reviews has a review of the Kodak Display Maker because somebody gave him one that they bought for $10 in Goodwill. Oh, so I beg
that's
you,
pretty cool.
That's what happened to that one. Currently, LGR has it. So if you want to see a review of the one that was new in box for $10 from Goodwill that got gotten donated to him, you can see a neat review of it. So we'll have a link to that in the show notes too. So it's kind of interesting to follow the trail of this thing, like crazy, terrible device that didn't sell at all, now for sale for $4,000 in eBay, but somebody else bought it for $10 and gave it to LGR. So I enjoyed the whole process of Googling that.
That's pretty wild.
Nice.
Yep.
It does look like it's the Lazy Game Reviews thing. It looks pretty good. I mean, like it's pretty 13-minute video. Nice quality video.
Yeah, LGR reviews are actually generally pretty good. Like, that's what, and so it goes in depth, and the one he got was essentially new in box. And it's amazing that something, like he even says, it's kind of weird that something would be, like Kodak never really advertised these things. You had to kind of know that they existed or went in to buy them, and stores and people, the retailers that would sell the video display stuff never really moved the Kodak stuff because nobody would want them. They're just, no, it was just a disaster of a product. But it does mean that somebody had one or bought one for many thousands of dollars back in the late 80s, left it in the box, never touched it, and eventually found its way to Goodwill. So it's odd the journey that that particular box took.
Yeah, I guess I would assume that it was somebody's, like, a store didn't sell it and had it in their back room or something. But
yeah, and eventually went under, and maybe nobody bought it at the store auction or bought it cheap at an auction, never used it or whatever. But I'm sure that display maker would have tales to tell if it could talk.
Tales of nobody paying attention to it.
And it would put them up in mediocre graphics, not as good as the competitor.
Cool. Well, I knew nothing about that before today, so excellent.
Yep, same. It's pretty crazy.
All right, let's see. So I have all random things. I sort of was flailing around on eBay just trying to see what it was, and this is what I found. So one thing I found was Vic 1211. Oh, this is also the guy in Nova Scotia.
Oh, sci-fi man.
So Vic 1211M, the Super Expander plus 3K RAM for the it's for an early Japanese version of the Vic 20 called the Vic 1001. And it provides...
I've never heard of that computer before. I mean, the VIC-20 I know, but I didn't know there were other versions
of
it.
Yeah, I guess it was predated the VIC-20 by a bit. This is an expander. It expands memory or whatever, but the thing that kind of like caught my attention is that it's different from the kind of analogous thing you can get for a VIC-20 because this has some utilities and functions that the other one lacks. In particular, the piano command that turns the VIC keyboard into a piano. So that's what you wanted. It's a $400 buy it now, but you can make an offer.
Eek. I have a question about the VIC-20. I think everybody would agree. Terrible computer. Nothing to recommend it. I mean, just awful. You know, fight me, VIC people, but whatever. But I've always assumed, therefore, Commodore came out with the... I also only just recently found out Commodore was like a Toronto-based company, like started in Canada. I'm like, what? Mm. What? That shocked me. Anyway, I've always assumed that the VIC-20 came out first and was like their... Fourier and said, oh, well, this is garbage. And so then they came out with the Commodore 64, bigger number and you know, better, in quotes, computer. Is that the case? Or was it the case that the Commodore 64 came out and then they wanted like an even cheaper version and said, well, the $400 or whatever they're selling the Commodore 64, like, can we go cheaper and sell a computer worth $10 or whatever the VIC-20 would have retailed for? Do you guys know, like, the order of production on these?
I'm not sure, but I think your first guess is the right one.
Yeah, that's basically my feeling as well.
I'm pretty sure the VIC-20 came first. And I think that, like, one of the things is there, someone will tell me I'm wrong, but there's like a video chip that I think is called the VIC, and the C64 is called the VIC-2, I think, and the VIC-20, I guess it's the VIC-1. I don't know. I've probably got it wrong, but I'm pretty sure that, like, the C64 is a descendant of the technology in the VIC-20, or an evolution of that technology.
Got it. Okay.
Pretty sure that's correct.
And I think I would say one reason to believe that is that I believe that the disk drive, the 1541 disk drive, actually had a, like, there are earlier ones that are sort of colored like the VIC-20. And then later models look, you know, their later models are the sort of whatever it is, tan,
brown,
whatever
color. Yeah.
Color.
Yeah, there's some that are cream and some that are beige, tan, whatever.
All the Commodore people are just flailing right now, listening as we talk about this.
But
I'm loving it.
Anyway, yeah. So the VIC-20. I don't know if there's much to say about that. I think it did have like sprites and stuff.
Probably had Sprite.
Right.
It came with a Sprite.
It just had Spr.
Okay, let's see. Next thing. Sticking with the Commodore theme. This is basically, I thought it was kind of an interesting device that I didn't know existed. It's not really a retro device, although it's getting to be almost. It's a quad port IEC bus, so it lets you plug in four different devices and switch between them. It is something that was designed in 2010. So, you know, it is for the modern, you know, modern sort of like things that you can plug into your Commodore computer that you can switch between them. But anyway, the auction says basically this guy had bought a spare one back when they were originally available and hasn't used it. So I was going to pass it on to whoever bids and gets it. So I thought it was interesting. I don't have a use for it myself, but it's neat that it exists.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
I think it's in this port that you can plug in the hard drive emulator or the floppy drive emulator, the flash memory things. So I think I have one device that I can plug in there. But okay, next thing. There is an Apple network server on eBay. I almost never see these.
Oh, the Shiner. Yeah.
So
cool. They're terrible.
It's a huge, huge, heavy machine. It is only arguably a Mac. It is arguably not a Mac.
I would argue it's not a Mac. It's not a Mac because the network server, unlike the... So there's the workgroup server. Good computer. Neat. Runs AUX, which is a Unix thing. And then there's the network server. Crappy computer. Runs AIX. Also a Unix thing. But if I remember, the network servers have a thing in the ROM specifically to make them not be able to boot macOS. Like they're just like an offensive, terrible thing. Like they put a thing in the ROM to force them to not be used as Macintoshes. What the heck, man?
Yeah.
I'm offended by this computer.
The sad state of affairs.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's one of these things that I sort of on principle wouldn't mind having one, except they're really big. As I understand it, they're very heavy. They look like little dorm fridges, basically. Down one side, there's a whole slew of bays to put in, like, drives or CDs and stuff like that.
Right.
This particular one, you know, it's interesting because they're rare. You know, you really do not see these at all.
Yeah, they don't come up much, yeah.
This one is so beat up, though, that I feel, you know, like, I don't know if I want it.
But would it clean up? I mean, it's beat up, but maybe in a way that's just cosmetic?
Possibly, yeah. There's some scuff marks that you could
Buff out.
Yeah. Right. I also don't quite understand why someone took a picture of some little window that says ROM version 1.1.22, whatever. But it seems like it's wet.
Why is it sideways? It seems like it's wet. And also the display on it is like falling down. It's like sinking.
Yeah, it's a weird angle. So like this...
Wow.
Not... The salespersonship on this is not so good.
But that's why maybe it'll just buff out and end up looking neat. I mean, you're right that they aren't a thing that comes up much. I'm just doing a double check on Wikipedia about these things to make sure I'm right about this text set. Yes. Okay, I was remembering this correctly. One of the things it's kind of famous for is when Gilamelio, because, you know, Apple, beleaguered Apple, was going out of business. So late 90s. In the exact same meeting, canceled the network server, yay, and OpenDoc, boo. So on the same day, poor one out for OpenDoc, but network server went down. So this one's rough, but you don't see these much. They have that particular 90s industrial design too, that the bottom of it, that looks like you could slide a DuoDoc into it, on the little foot thing in it. And I don't know. I kind of like this era of industrial design. I love it, but I have a bit more nostalgia for it than I would have thought. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have thought it would age as well, but it's not a good computer. Yeah, man. No. The fact that you can't, like, because it would be so cool if this could just run the classic Mac. If you could boot this as a Mac and just have a whole bunch of drives in it,
this would have been a really cool Mac.
But the fact that they just, like, put a thing in ROM specifically to stop that is just mean, man.
I wonder if you can sort of swap in a different ROM, and if that suddenly makes this whole thing pointless because, you know, you just get a newer Mac then as well.
Right. It just becomes like kind of the world's biggest Mac.
But so this is if you want to buy it now, it's $3,000. So they're aware that it's unusual, but it's also, you can make an offer for it. It is in Orland, California. Okay. Anyway, I thought it was weird to see it.
But yeah, I feel like in general, like, it's cool to see, but, like, overall, I would rather have a VIC-20 than have this.
Yeah.
And that's saying something. Because I really don't want a VIC-20.
I don't really want either of them, but I think I'd take this one. Because I could take this one and probably sell it for a few grand. The VIC-20, like, how are you going to offload that thing? Yeah, Vic people. I mean, you didn't think you were going to get attacked this much in the show, did you?
I sort of feel like, I mean, you know, I'm very conflicted about it. If one walked in,
you want one, don't you?
Along with like a warehouse to store things in, then, I would sort of like it just on principle, but, yeah. Anyway, okay. The next thing is not even. I don't really know why this showed up in my list, and I didn't know what it was for a little while. But anyway, it is a Scotch cassette letter, and I don't know. I mean, this is, it's not computing. It's sort of vintage tech of some kind. But essentially the conceit here is that it's a cassette that you can mail to somebody with like a voice message on it.
But isn't that any cassette?
So
what makes this different than just like it's a cassette tape?
Well, on the box, there's a place to put a sender's address and a recipient's address and some stamps.
Okay, got it. What is the little bar? There's a bar inserted into it.
I think it's to hold the reels.
Just to stop.
Yeah, it's just so they don't turn.
So they don't rotate out while it's in transit? Yeah. Okay.
So that's actually kind of cool.
I kind of like this thing and want to get it, and I'll record you guys a 20-minute podcast. And just
that's
it.
Cool. Oh, and it actually comes with a bunch of replaceable labels, so you can send it back and forth to your correspondent.
Nice. I used to do this. I hated it, but I don't even want to tell you guys because people will start calling me this. It's terrible. So as a kid, people would sometimes call me Carry, Carry. I never liked it. Don't do it. I won't answer to it. Screw you all. Call me Carrington or throw things at me. Both of those are acceptable. But man, I want to be worth all three syllables, but whatever. So getting past that, moving on, never mentioning it again. I used to, I was courting a girl who would go away to summer camp. And she was always bored. So I would record like songs for her and like make mixtapes, but with like, I would also voice messages, all that kind of stuff. And I would send them up to her and I called it Carry FM, Carry FM. Cause up here in Canada, all our radio stations start with C, cause we didn't go wireless. I guess, I don't know. So I did a whole series for this whole summer of Carry FM tapes that would go off and it'd be my own little radio broadcast thing. And so it was super fun. So I could have used this back then.
Cool. And I assume they are now gone, right? I mean, you sent them away and you...
No, she said she kept all of them. I ran into her years ago and she's got them all. So I want to say, can I digitize them? Let me hear what the heck I was doing back then. I kept all my ridiculous tapes.
That's cool.
Nice.
Yeah. I have failed to court in many, many creative ways. I made a whole zine once just to court a person. I published a whole zine that was just for one reader. Failed then too. I remember for like 6 months, I put a bi-monthly zine, like two, or whatever you call it, bi-weekly, every 2 weeks. Put out a whole like 8-page
Excellent.
I was always punching above my weight.
This is like a zine about a specific topic to impress this person, kind of?
No, just like a zine of stuff I was interested in. Just to kind of like, and it was more about me. You see how this fails?
It does seem like it.
So I'm saying, you know, get to know me through my zine. I just look back on my failures. There are many, many in absolute. So.
That's beautiful.
Anyway, so what I'm saying is I could have used a cassette letter.
However, so... given what we were saying earlier, your girlfriend listens to this now, right? So this was so.
Oh yeah, but she's aware of all my failures.
So as it turns out, it was all for the best.
Exactly, right? I keep telling her she's the crooked road I had to walk, man.
Cool. Okay, let's see. There are a couple other things. I might as well keep going. So I found an Atari portfolio, which looked kind of nice. I keep getting sucked into these. Like I see them and they look neat. This one looks like it's in relatively good shape. It has a couple of little, I don't know what they are, cartridges? What are these things, Jack?
Yeah, those are things that you can store programs on them. So like it doesn't have like any kind of floppies or anything. Those things act as kind of a floppy. It's like a RAM. It's like a non-volatile RAM of some kind. Usually they're battery backed up somehow. It's not like an SD card. It's got a battery in it.
Ooh, battery backed up. That's
yeah,
dangerous.
So you gotta change those things out now and then. I think there are modern replacements that are just built around an SD card. This particular auction that you posted, however, Paul, it's just ended.
Just ended
15 minutes ago.
Paul bought
it. That's interesting. It wasn't mine. Now. Okay, I did not. I had loaded it up before. Okay, so that suggests to me that it was, in fact, not badly priced. Because it looked like it was $150, which seemed like not bad.
So yeah, it looks all right.
I came with a couple of these things.
Yep.
Physically, how large are these things? The photo doesn't give me a sense of how big a portfolio
about
is.
About the size of like a VHS tape, I'd say.
Oh.
That's pretty big.
Maybe a bit smaller, but somewhere around there.
Probably a joy to type on.
Yeah, that little chiclet keyboard, though. Ooh.
But I think that they move pretty easily, those keys. It's not like it's not very stiff, if I recall right. I don't actually have one. I keep trying to get these in auctions here, and I keep failing. I set a price that seems right to me, and then I get that, you know, that price gets tripled in the last 30 minutes. Like, oh, okay, not buying that.
Yep. Okay, see, the next thing, I don't know if this is... I never know if these are interesting, but okay, this is an Epson HX20. These have come up several times. It is, it's a little, it's basically, I don't even know how to describe it. It's the same kind of thing as like a TRS-80 Model 1. It is, I believe, a less powerful cousin of the PX-8, but it looks a little bit like the PX-8.
And unlike that Sharp computer, this has a cassette recorder thingy.
Yes, it has like a little micro cassette recorder. It comes with this particular one, and so it comes with a hard case that Epson provides for these, so it fits nicely in there and protects it. It has, I think...
Wait, is that like a receipt printer on the left side?
Yeah. So it has a little printer. It has a little...
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. They're kind of neat little machines. They, I believe, don't run any recognizable operating system. I mean, I think it's its own thing. But I think what was kind of neat about this is it just, you know, it has the case, it has the machine itself, everything looks like it's in good shape. They have the original receipts, an extra printer ribbon, who, you know, of course that's not likely to be that useful, but original.
But might be inkable. A lot of old ribbons you can ink back up.
Yeah, and I think it's probably just black and white. So anyway, if you were interested in an HX20, this looks pretty, I don't know, is it still available? It was $120, buy it now, free shipping from Missouri.
I need that it comes in a little portable case and it's got a little receipt printer. So I could have this thing and then like at the end of a conversation with a friend, I could, you know, print out a little invoice. I just kind of like slide it across the table in a little billfold. Just like, you know, when you're ready.
Yeah, I like it. I think this actually is not bad. If I didn't already have a couple of these, I would be tempted. But, okay. The next thing, I actually went to search for this. It's ThinkPad 701C because I saw someone had a little video of them having one. I've never seen one of these before, but the interesting thing about it is that it has what people are referring to as a butterfly keyboard.
Hmm. Yeah, the one that folds out, right?
It's really strange. I had not seen it actually, and you can't really tell exactly from this auction, but I've seen a movie of it, and as you open it up, the keyboard sort of like slides into place, like it becomes wider. I don't even know exactly how it works, but it's in several pieces, and then slides together to make something that's actually wider than the body of the thing. I've never used one. I've never seen it except in this movie, but it looks cool. And in the comments to the movie on Facebook that somebody put, all the comments are like, oh, you have a working one, which suggests to me that they don't work as a rule. It does seem like it's a new, an extra point of failure. But
it does. It's the same thing nowadays with folding screens, which I know is going to be the new hotness coming up soon. Hey, people from the future. Yeah, we were looking at those folding screens coming up. They were just as big of a disaster as I think they're going to be, right, future people? So I think it's the same thing. It seems like a non-starter way to go in that eventually we'll probably have like LCDs that can stretch, and so you pull out your phone and you just kind of stretch it out to the size you want, and that'll make a lot more sense. But something that folds, there's no way that doesn't get a crease or a crack or what. That's going to drive me crazy. but that's future things. Same thing here. I think that the mechanism, because all it did was give you a slightly large, it didn't, you weren't starting with something the size of a phone and folding out a full-size keyboard. Mm-hmm. You were starting with something the size of a ultra notebook and bring it out to the size of a small laptop. So slightly bigger keys, which is cool, but I think it introduced a lot of points of failure for a relatively small game.
I actually posted a video in the show notes also. You guys can take a look at it if you like. It shows the action. Mm-hmm. So action. Like it kind of splits diagonally, and the right side, as you close the lid, the right side scoots upward and then to the left, and the left side up scoots rightward. Well, not upward, but forward towards the screen.
So it's cool, right? Like you can see, like when I saw that, I thought, "Oh, I have to see if I can get one."
Right. Yeah, I mean, I'd always thought this looked cool, but I've never even seen one in front of me.
Yeah.
The ThinkPads as a whole weathered the years well aesthetically. You can look at an old ThinkPad because the lovely black color and stuff like that, and go, "That looks cool." I mean, they look chunky and heavy, but compared to a lot of computers of its era. You could rock one of these and not be like, what are you using? Like,
right.
Other than that little key nipple thing, which I know people love it, but I'm like, come on, man.
Are you like, come on?
I think the part of the reason that design has aged well, in a sense, is that design still exists. So you can buy a brand new ThinkPad today, and it still pretty much looks like this. It's still just a black rectangle. Like, they haven't really changed the basic design much, for better or for worse.
Yep.
So to the untrained eye, a brand new ThinkPad looks identical to a 10-year-old ThinkPad. You know, if you look close, you can...
Well, I got to tell you, as an untrained eye, you're correct.
Oh, yeah, I think we actually did talk about this once before, like looking at like new ThinkPads, and like somebody had, that's right, they were actually making like a retro version of one, and you were complaining that you couldn't actually tell which was like the retro one.
Yeah, I couldn't tell the difference.
Well, they still make ThinkPads then, and we found out recently Epson still makes impact printers. You can get yourself a pretty cool, sweet, brand new 2019 retro setup.
Okay, and then the last thing I had. So what I was trying to do, I saw something that Jack had put in the closing notes, and so I thought, all right, well let me see if I can find some sort of like Halloween based retro thing on eBay, and I searched and I could not. So I thought, all right, well, how about maybe like a pumpkin themed retro thing? Mm-hmm. And I searched and I also could not find anything pumpkin themed. So what I went with was Ortho's computerized gardening for the Apple II Plus, which is very distantly related to Halloween.
Distantly.
But, it's a seasonal product.
Yeah.
And we're in a season right now, so.
That's right. Perfect. But yeah, so one thing that is sort of funny about this is that, I mean, it feels like kind of a ridiculous thing. There's it's a big green binder. It has it's from Ortho software. You know, I doubt Ortho made a lot of software. You know, they make like weed killer and stuff, right?
Right.
And it comes with a program, the personalized plant selector, on a nice yellow disc and a nice green sleeve, and it comes with a big book on gardening techniques. 192 page book. And the thing I think that what kind of caught my eye about this partly is that this is at least the third one I know that exists because I have one. Mark at Kansas Fest had one. I think he gave it away. And then this is the third one. So there's a surprising number of these out there given how like ridiculously obscure it must have been.
Right.
Are they copy protected? Has it been cracked?
I don't know. Actually, it's definitely. I
mean, is this a preserved thing?
It's definitely been.
That doesn't seem like a lot.
It's been imaged for sure.
Okay, cool.
I don't remember if it was protected. And I have yet to bring myself to scan the 192-page gardening techniques book.
What?
So I should.
Someone's got to, Paul.
That's right. It does not seem like it's at the high end of my priorities, but anyway, whatever. That was my attempt at a Halloween
theme. I like
theme.
It. Happy Halloween.
Okay. Anyway, I think we're ready for closing discussions. Carrington, any closing notes?
Not retro computer based. Went Halloween shopping for decoration things today, which is late because I love Halloween. Love it, love it, love it, love it, love it. So my gal and I are putting up giant inflatable spiders and spider webs and that kind of stuff, and it's super awesome. I like fun Halloween. As a kid, I loved horror movies. I still love them. Zombie things and gore things and super scary stuff. But for Halloween, I like smiling ghosts and fun witches and like dogs with sheets over their heads to look like ghosts in cartoons. Like, I like that kind of Halloween. I like fun kid Halloween, not like gory, scary stuff. So I dig it. My absolute favorite holiday. So I will be in full Halloween mode for the next couple of weeks.
Excellent. Can hardly wait.
In Canada, we have Canadian Halloween. We celebrate it in November.
Correct. Yeah. I see.
As far as you know.
Okay. Yeah. And I guess the next scheduled recording will be after that, so we can hear all about your adventures and, you know, your arrests or whatever.
Well, actually, for Halloween's coming up in a couple of weeks, or for our listeners, it was
That's
6 weeks ago.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Jack, any closing thoughts?
Yeah. So just on it being the Halloween season, I wanted to mention a YouTube channel that I like called Crazy 80s Games, hosted by someone whose name I do not know, but he goes through, I think it's entirely Atari 8-bit games, at least what I've seen so far, which is cool as far as I'm concerned. That's my jam. And his latest episode is Obscure Atari 8-Bit Halloween Games, Part 1. So I hope there'll be a Part 2.
Ooh, Part 1.
This shows five games: Ghost Chaser, House of Usher, Nightmare Manor, Haunted Hill, and The Domain of the Undead.
Ooh.
And some of them look fun. So...
Right. Non-zero number look fun.
Fun not guaranteed.
It's for the listeners to decide, for the viewer to decide which looks fun. We may have different opinions. No, actually, the very first one looks actually pretty sweet. I might have to check this out.
Nice.
So, actually, I'll probably check them all out. Who am I kidding? I'll play all these games.
That's right. Yeah, your mentioning of the title of the video reminded me of... I never know if I've mentioned these things before, but there's a musician named Mike Furman who has an album that has, I think, one of the greatest titles. It's called The Very Last Songs I Will Ever Record, Part 1.
But, yeah, that's excellent.
Anyway, whatever. He writes like comedy music. But
cool.
Nice. Yeah, like Furman. Oh, I forgot to mention, for people who like Halloween, if you haven't watched it, my favorite Halloween video thing to watch is Beyond the Garden Wall. So some people know it and love it. Some people never heard of it. It's not super obscure. But if you haven't and you're looking for a new thing to watch for Halloween, Over the Garden Wall. I love it. Yet I don't know what it's called. Over the Garden Wall. It's weird. It's a slow burn. It's only a few episodes, 6 or something like that. They're called chapters. It's strange, but it wraps up beautifully and explains most of the really weird stuff you've seen. A complete delight of oddity and to get you in the Halloween spirit.
Cool.
So, Over the Garden Wall, highly recommend.
Nice. I have not seen this. My kids have seen it. They've talked about it, but I have not seen it at all. I got to check this thing out.
Hmm. Yeah, strongly recommend it. And by the end, yes, you will understand why the one person has a teapot on their head. All is explained.
Excellent. Yeah, I do remember, and that's at some point in the past has gone into a list of mine based on your recommendation.
Yeah, I continue to recommend it. I watch it every year for Halloween.
I continue to not quite get around to watching it, but maybe this year.
Yeah. See you next year, Paul.
Right. Let's see. For me, I have a fancy new computer that is going to speed up my editing, but this setting up of that computer has slowed down my editing. So, so 2 weeks ago, we did a 200th episode of the RCR, and that's excellent, and pretty soon everyone will be able to hear it. Oh, and actually the other thing too, I don't know where this fits, but might as well be here. We are considering the possibility of reviving the practice of streaming as we record on YouTube. So we're working on trying to get the technology behind that, but if that happens, and if you hear this before the next recording, we may well be trying to just sort of essentially just live stream as we record, but that'll allow people to type comments and suggest things that we're forgetting and tell us how wrong we are about the chronology of the VIC-20 or whatever. And, so we're working on that. I think if it shows up, it'll, I believe, show up on the RCR podcast YouTube feed. So we will try to announce it sometime before it happens. We tried to do it for the 200th, and then we tried again today. And 202 is going to be the lucky one, I think.
Yeah.
202, what is that? That's DC, right? I think it's the Washington, DC area code. Otherwise, yeah, I don't know. Just a lot of stuff, a lot of real world work has kept me away from doing things that need doing. But any minute now, that's going to stop. Any minute now, I will have oodles of free time.
Any minute now.
Okay, anything else?
I'm good.
So that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can also find out about the VCF festival shows at that same site. If we don't mention them, they will be there. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast or at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to us at feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And we are a member of the Throwback Network, I think. Is that a thing still? We will continue to say that until the end of the podcast. That Throwback Network is at throwbackreviews.com at a link in the show notes. You could write a review on iTunes if you want. And until next time,
Retro Compute!